Thank you
very much, Tony, for stepping in at the last minute.
Thank you. It's always... Is that still on? Did you turn that off? There's a switch there. I just have to shout.
No, well, I'm putting you back.
Okay. Some people will tell you that I'm always happy to shout, but that's all right. Thank you very much, St. Andrews, Steve and Jeff and Noel in particular, for an opportunity to come and have a chat. And those of you who know, both Sandra and I will know that we're always happy to stand up and talk with people. But hopefully we won't bore you to death today. But there are a couple of things that we wanted to talk about. First one is to, if I can get this thing working. Don't normally need to go to this extent of mucking around with a show, but I've got something that you might like to see. So, put that in there. That's probably... Can you still hear that? That's not going to sit up tight. It's going to be tighter. Okay. That's going to improve. So firstly, we're Salvation Army, we're about to head into May. So this is a gentle reminder. Thanks, Rob. Thank you. This is a gentle reminder that The Red Shield Appeal is about to start. We have a focus on homelessness and the vulnerable in our community. This is a particular issue for the Australian community this year, coming off the back of COVID. We know that there are a lot of people who in previous years would not have stepped up and asked for help. Today we're starting to see a number who do, and particularly those who are stepping out of the job seeker program, who are struggling with rentals and struggling with the cost of living, even in a regional community like ours. So we are looking for volunteers to sit and do static collections in our shopping centres and supermarkets and that sort of thing across the region. We have a few people booked for Genderbine. We are still looking for some people who might be able to sit at one of the three centres here in Cooma. And there is a possibility we might have some opportunities in other towns across the region as well throughout May. if I can have a couple of minutes at the May breakfast, we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. But please contact us at the Army, either Sandra or myself, if you think you might have an hour or two that you can spare, and come and join us on a roster. I will say, on the Red Shield in particular, I'd like to acknowledge the work of certain people. In particular, Steve, who for many years had a critical role in this particular campaign across Cooma. I would like to acknowledge George, Bernie and Frank for the support and work that they do in our family store and across our mission space in that as well. So national launch for Red Shield is the 29th of April, and then you'll be hearing more from us on that. So, I've titled this A Privileged Life, and compared to people who were homeless, compared to people who had ongoing generational struggles in life, I've had a privileged life. Mostly, though, I say I have a privileged life because I know God and I've known God most of my life, and that's a little bit of that story is what we'll talk about this morning. But first of all, I want to introduce you to someone special, and someone who's special to me. my mother's brother, Philip Kenyon Chapman, passed away on Monday in the US. If you're watching the ABC News on Monday night, you would have seen the obituary that I'm about to show you. But Philip, I'll talk about him after I've shown you the obituary, I think. Play the video.
So for 5 years, during the height of the space race, he died on Monday in the U.S. state of Arizona after suffering from heart disease back in 1969.
NASA's first Australian-born...
The man who trained to become the first Australian-born astronaut, Philip Chapman, has died aged 86. Although he never made it into space, Dr. Chapman worked with NASA for 5 years during the height of the space race.
No,
he died on Monday in the U.S. state of Arizona after suffering from heart disease. Back in 1969, he spoke to the agency as he was training for an Apollo mission. Sure, that's a terrible.
From flying Tiger Moths with the Sydney University Squadron, to being trained in American Air Force supersonic jets for space flights. Dr. Philip Chapman was the only foreign-born astronaut in the American manned spacecraft program in 1969, the year man first landed on the moon.
It's conceivable that I might get to the moon in one of the very later flights, but my immediate involvement is likely to be in the orbit.
After serving in the Australian Air Force Reserves and working as a scientist in Antarctica, Dr. Chapman moved to America and joined NASA in 1967.
Do you have any special pride in being an Australian-born astronaut?
Yes, I think I do. It's a matter of sheer chance, and I'm happy to turn that way.
Chosen from over 900 applicants, Dr. Chapman was among only a handful of scientist astronauts trained to live and work in orbital stations in NASA's early space program.
If I'm in the Apollo applications program, I'll be one of the three-man crew, and we'll be doing a series of experiments which are connected with astronomy, solar physics, Earth resources.
But it was never to be. NASA's plans for a space station didn't happen until much later. Nonetheless, Dr. Chapman still went through the rigorous training demanded of all Apollo astronauts. After 5 years with NASA, Dr. Chapman resigned in 1972 near the end of the Apollo program. But he continued to work in space technology for much of his life, his illustrious career matched only by his lofty ambitions for space exploration.
Is it possible you may be on the first team that will go to Mars?
Well, I have to hurry up. I don't expect that we will be going to Mars until sometime in the 80s. At the very earliest, and I think I'll probably be too old by the time.
With that mission yet to even be attempted, there's still time for other Australian space pioneers to reach for the stars.
The man who trained to become the first
astronaut. Nothing like technology to give joy in the day. A privileged life. A lot of people would say that Phil, who achieved an awful lot in his life and did exactly what he wanted to do, had a privileged life. I'll miss my uncle. Not as much, perhaps, as I might miss a close friend. Here's a man who joined NASA in the early in the late 60s, became an astronaut, never flew, was flight controller for a number of the Apollo flights, was a physicist who was responsible for the design of the tiles on the space shuttle, one of the mathematicians working on Skylab. He developed the RISC chip in a team of scientists at MIT. This is the computer chip that drives all the computers you use in your telephones today. He was employed by the US government in his 70s to develop geothermal energy options for the US. There are a whole lot of different things there you'll see. If you watch a program, Fly Me to the Moon, it's supposed to be on the ABC tonight about 6 o'clock, they'll talk about using a laser to ionise fuel for space flight. Phil was one of the pioneers in that area. This is stuff that, after a long delay, largely through political and economic necessity, I guess, Nixon put a stop to the space program as it stood during the Apollo days. Phil did a great deal to help develop and progress a whole lot of the things that we see working in our life today. But here is a man who, I think the last time I had a call from him was when my sister died about 10 years ago. We've been in touch maybe 5 or 6 times in the last 60 years. He's a person who didn't relate to his family, didn't relate to people. 3, maybe 4 marriages. Had a lot of interesting stuff going in his life, but the personal side, perhaps not so good. See, ask yourself, where does the privilege sit? Is it in the things that we do? Is it in the people that we know? Is it in how we live our life or who we are? And for me, and if this is going to work, I'll go back that way. So a bit about my family and my background. And I'm sharing Phil Chapman with you because he was an important part of our family, but he was completely separate to our family at the same time. I come from a family of people who were effective in what they did. Mum was a journalist. She wrote very well for many, many years. My grandfather was a journalist. Before that, he was on the wool board in the publicity area. They've all been around different things. They have all stood apart from knowing God. So when I describe my life as privileged, I talk about knowing God and my and where I sit. Let's, I'll be there. Here we are, that one. So my walk with God started when we were small children. Back in the 60s, it was the dumb thing that you sent your kids to Sunday school. So the nearest church was an Anglican church, so we went to Sunday school. And I can remember, and I haven't talked about this much, but I can remember sitting in Sunday school one day. I was about 4 and a half years old. And I can remember seeing a bright light. It might have just been the sun coming through the window, but I can remember seeing a bright light, and I can remember hearing the words in my head while the Sunday school teacher was talking, "I am God your Father." And as far as I'm concerned, I had a vision of God. And I knew from that point that the God that the Christian church talks about is real, and I needed to be part of that. And I gave my life to Christ. I was 7 or 8, eight years old, we moved to French's Forest in Sydney, and I went to the church there, and through that church at a large youth fellowship, and we had 2 churches in the parish. One of them had a Latin Mass in the morning, unusual for an Anglican church in Sydney. The other one had a youth fellowship of about 300 people. I learnt what it meant to believe in God, other than just having this thing that I had to be part of. So I've been fortunate. I come from a family who have focused on things other than God, who actively worked against having a faith. For over 50 years, I was the only Christian in my family. I give praise to God that one of my nieces has found him and is very active in her local church in Sydney now. So what do we say? Life is interesting. We had mum and dad found that having a person of faith in the house difficult, and in my late teens I was asked to leave home. I was helped out into a place to live, and we had a broken relationship for between 6 months and 12 months, and eventually rebuilt that relationship and had a good one right through mum's life, and that's continuing with my dad nowadays. Still doesn't have what we call a faith. Though dad did say when my sister passed away that he knows that when he said this thing, he said, "Don't worry about me." He said, "I'm not going to get into the religion thing. I don't like the whole idea of church, and I don't like the bigotry, and I don't like the hypocrisy and all the stuff that people put up as reasons not to attend church." But he did say, "When I look at a blade of grass, I know that there is a God out there. When I see the world around me, I know that there is a God out there, and it's not about the people." So I'm at peace with where Dad's at. and as I said, we now have a good relationship. So we went from school, went to work at an early age, I've had four careers effectively, worked as an optician out of school, did that for nearly 40 years. I worked in the computer industry for a period, some of that together with working in the other one. Eventually I came to Canberra, that was in 2001, and took on a role for a company as a regional manager in that area, and I managed a number of stores for that company that was eventually taken over by the OPSM group, and I worked for them for a few years again for the second time. During that period, I've been through a marriage and a divorce. I've been, I'll put it this way, I've been wealthy. We had a place in Mosman. Lost that. That's how life goes. I've been poor, and I know what it's like to live on both sides of that particular divide. So when I look at something like the Red Shield, I've never been homeless, thankfully. I've always had somewhere to sleep. But, you know, you learn from your experiences, and you learn from the experiences of people around us, from our friends and the people in the community that we mix with and we work with and or we fellowship with. In all that time, the sense of Christ as my Lord and the sense of God the Father as having a relationship with him has never left me. Outside the church for a while, never left my faith. Can't do that, it's too real. So all of those things came together a few years ago. Married Sandra. I'm blessed by that. That's opened up doors that I thought were closed. My ministry for a long time was in what we call the marketplace. So I know that some here would understand what I mean by that, but you minister to people in the work that you do and in the life that we lead without wearing a badge or a label. Nowadays, I stand here as an officer of the Salvation Army, and I'm a warranted officer, not commissioned. We're still learning. This is another career. It's a wonderful thing to do. And we do hope and pray for good opportunities as we go through this. And as Sandra and I grow, and as we learn ministry, as we learn to share the Word of God and to share the love of Christ through the store or through supporting people with financial needs or in crisis, bushfire, drought, homelessness, can't meet the rent this week, can't feed the children, can't put petrol in the car, can't afford to go to the doctor, all the various things that come up to us every week now. We can stand here and know that our God is a God of provision, and that the life that we have and the life that we get to lead and that I'm privileged to be part of, it just continues to be blessed. And it's wonderful to be part of the community here in Cooma and part of the Christian community here in Cooma and have an opportunity to share that. So that's a fairly brief testimony on my part from where we sit. It's been interesting. We've got a long way to go. I will say that in terms of the work that we do here, yes, we have our fundraisers like Red Shield. Those things are critical. COVID has meant that the Army's ability to finance its work has been greatly reduced. We've shifted the Red Shield appeal to an online appeal this year, and we are allowed to have some static collections. Door knocks are still a grey area. But that's only part of what we do. You know, every day during the week across the country, or 3 days a week here in Cooma, we help people with second-hand goods and with recycling products. We employ staff and volunteers. We give them an opportunity. It's never easy, and I get that, and I really appreciate the work that the team do. But to be able to do this is a privilege. So I guess what I can say is that when you step up to help others, when we walk alongside others, as the Army says, to transform lives one at a time through the love of Christ, it can be through physical work, it can be through being available as an ear to support, it can be through ministry or through church, or mostly it's just about building relationship with people. Stand up and do that and be blessed, because our God is great. Amen. Any questions? That's correct. We are responsible for the, from the Army's perspective, from the Hume Highway down to the coast to the border, across the whole of the Monaro region. It is. So, I mentioned earlier to Rob that I got some news. I need to say that. We got advised last night that a lease has been signed on our new store property. And we will now be able to start progressing the changes that we've needed. Salvation Army is moving into a property in Vale Street. Our store will be rebranded as a Salvo store and managed by our corporate retail managers, so that Sandra and I are free, largely, to focus on the ministry across this broad region. So over the next few months you'll see some work down there. We're also going to move our ministry centre. Will be located between St Vincent de Paul and the Hub, and are working towards purchasing those two buildings so that we have permanency in this region. Exciting stuff. The store will be in what used to be the supermarket and the old garage.
Next to
Vinnie's. And then our worship centre will be where the hip pocket shop used to be, in the building next door. It does mean change. It does mean that to be able to purchase those buildings, we will, the Army will, relinquish the site of Mittagang Road at some point. So, better change for how we're seen here in town, but we will no longer be at the mercy of the landlord. And we will be right in the centre of town where we can be most effective in what we do. And you'll see a lot more of us. And you'll see a lot more of us out on the street. Plans are to have a kitchen, coffee, tea and a drop-in centre, as well as a place for supporting people, as well as a retail store which helps to fund it.
Tony, what's been your read in terms of the effect of COVID and people's need for spirituality or creativity? And that has COVID sort of brought more opportunities for you and Sandra?
In this area, COVID hasn't had such a massive impact. Not really, not on the population. Other than for us, we've reduced our income by nearly half. So there's been an impact to the Army, and there's definitely an impact for families. Those who've been fortunate enough to receive JobKeeper or a job seeker payment, those have been wound back, and we are expecting to see a lot more people stand up and say, I can't manage anymore. And when you build those relationships and you provide that support to people, that's where we have an opportunity to share in mission. And people are asking questions. Look, when we started here back in 2018, we had a few regular committed members of the Corps. That number has tripled. And in the last year, we've got three or four additional people who haven't come to the Army and haven't come out of a church, another church. We're not poaching people. These are people who are coming forward and saying, I want to know more about God and I want to be part of this community.
And Tony, if I may, I'm sorry, the subject has come up in my conversations with people around here, but not just. What's the state of homelessness in Cooma? Now, there was been a someone putting together their car.
Yes.
But someone else said that 28 people have not been in the tumor. In terms of the reality, what is the reality of that?
I don't know. I don't know the numbers at this point. We do know that, yes, there's a person in their car at Nijong. That person has had lots of opportunity to live elsewhere and has made a decision not to. You have to support people where they're at, and for some people, the idea of not being of a fixed address is important. We do know that emergency accommodation, short-term accommodation for people across the Monero is pretty much non-existent now. So where you have domestic violence or you have a broken relationship or you have I can't afford my rent anymore, we're starting to see more of that, definitely. But actual numbers of people on the street right now, not sure. We know that as we come into winter, those people will tend to move down to Bega or up to the north coast or to southeast Queensland where it's warmer and it's a much safer place to be. So, but there is a specific need for housing and for social housing and for supporter housing for people across the whole of this region and the whole of New South Wales that we can be sure about. We're still seeing one, on average, between one and three people a week with housing stress. So that's significant.
Sorry, just want to make an observation, Tony. Some years ago, for a few years, I was involved in the Richfield doorknock, and one year I thought I drew a short straw, I ended up with the area down behind the White Bay Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly depressing area.
It's challenging, isn't it?
I feel really bad going around asking these people to donate when they all look as though they actually need help rather than have excess money to give. But what I found was that those people down there were really keen to give. I mean, sometimes there was only 50 cents or something or a dollar. But whereas you didn't get any of what you got in some of the more affluent areas, if you like, where people say, no thanks, not interested or something, but those people, despite the fact that they were obviously not that well off, were willing to contribute. It's an observation if I'm not going to.
Oh, I agree entirely. Before we moved here, we had an area, the Benioth and Isabella Plains area, to collect for the army, and we find that those people who know what it's like to struggle in life are the most generous. Now, there are clear exceptions, Jeff.
Yeah, sure.
As we know, you know, this church and the family in this church have been most generous, and we certainly appreciate that. It's wonderful. It's much easier. You know, the Bible talks about the woman who gave a few coins in her tithe to the church and did so quietly and was praised by Christ, rather than the people who stood up and said, here is my $1 million equivalent. People should be encouraged to offer the support that they can to members of our community in the best way they can. And for some that might be a few hours doing stuff. We're not door knocking specifically in this area, though we think we might be allowed to in some parts of the area, but there are restrictions, and the COVID restrictions on a door knock are really difficult. So we have a digital door knock, and we're encouraging people to donate online where they can, or come and see us in the church if they can't. At the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to fund housing for people. We're trying to fund food, schooling assistance, medical assistance, and the other things that help people live. The Army, the Uniting Church, the Anglicans, Catholics, everybody gets in together. In this area, Mission Australia have a Commonwealth contract for assisting people with homelessness issues through Link to Home, and we work very closely with them. Last winter we put on average 3 people a week up in a hotel or at the caravan park for a period. They're all full now. So the last set that we had knocking on the door a week ago, we've had to send to Queanbeyan, and they're almost full. So it's challenging.
And if I may ask another personal question, how do you deal with threats? Now, I get that in the work of being a Salvation Army, supposed to do a Sandro, get frustrated.
Yes. I'll talk about me, okay? We all manage our anxieties and stress levels differently. For me, prayer is essential. Take those pressures and the things of the world and push them aside, put them at the foot of the cross. But prayer doesn't stand on its own in this. It's the most important thing, I think, but we also need to be conscious of our mental health, our physical health, take time to do things. In the middle of preparing for this, we have a uni course that we're doing with an assignment that's due in a few days' time. We've got all this other stuff going on. I took myself off to Canberra last night for a few hours to play model cars with some friends. So I have some hobbies and things. That like the photo background here, for example, was from our backyard. I have some things that I use to step myself out. For me, I need quiet time. Sandra's the opposite of that. So the ministry work, as you well know, very difficult, and it does apply a lot of stresses on relationship and on marriage. And I wouldn't say that it's easy, but that's the key, I think. Keep focused on the cross and remember to have the time that you need. So this year, for example, we've made a very clear decision to not work on a Friday. And there are sometimes funerals and other things that mean you can't do that. So you take some other time off. I've made... and I think the team would recognise this, a fairly conscious decision to step back from some of the day-to-day stuff within the store and leave it to the team to do so that I've got enough headspace to be able to function properly. And you just have to, you have to set boundaries. It's important.
Three or three years ago, in our church, we were looking at some... activities to help those who are really struggling as a result of drought and really hitting the farming community, especially on young families, young people. And the question arose, who are those people? How do you contact them? How do you reach out to them? And part of them maybe from a local paper, but then again, do they buy it if they're so desperate for money, help, whatever? Which organisations, including your own organisation, actually know who these people are at any time that is really struggling financially, a lot of hardship?
You know,
it seems as though we should just put up a shop and then just let people walk in, maybe, but otherwise.
it's interesting that the people, and particularly people who are well established, so here we're talking about the farming community, people with land, people with businesses, when they find themselves in strife, where there's a crisis, be it a natural crisis like drought or flood or bushfire, or a financial crisis that arises from overcommitment or insufficient funds or whatever the story might be, people, and I can say this, I think, across this region in particular, very resilient. People tend not to put their hand up. I'd say if it was an organisation who had the most vision over the financial difficulties people have, it would be council. And it will be council because they don't pay their rates. It's because they don't pay their bills. There is no formal register of people in need. I don't know that that's the best way to approach things like this. It's when you know of people, sometimes people will put their hand up and say, I don't know what to do anymore, I can't cope anymore. I'm desperate and I've never been like this and I'm embarrassed and I don't want to talk to people about it, but I can't pay my power bill. Or I can't afford the trip to Canberra to see the specialist. That's the sort of stuff that comes up. And they approach us and the other agencies in the area. So we've got in this area MCAS, Minera Family Support, the Uniting Church, Anglicare, St Vinny's, Salvation Army, Mission Australia, Centrelink, Police Service, and other government organisations who work very well together. We have a committee of people across the Monero and across the all the organisations who work in social support in the Monero, whether it's schooling or the kind of supports that we provide, meet once a month online and we share and we converse about stuff, and if there's something come up, we're on the phone to the people who can help. So in terms of providing a provision for people, we saw this in the bushfire where so many houses were burnt down in the area, and we were fortunate on the Monero that the numbers were much less than they were in other areas. People who have lost everything, or people who are about to lose everything, tend to not want to replace what they had with something somebody else has used before. So they might take some second-hand clothing in a crisis, they might take some second-hand furniture in a crisis, and they'll come to us and the other opportunity stores if that's what they need. But mostly what people are looking for is the financial support to get re-established with the things that are important to them. So, you know, people often ask us, I've got a bed that's slightly broken, but surely someone can use it. No, they can't. If it's damaged, dispose of it properly, take it to the tip. What we can use is the funds that helps a person buy a new one to their choice, to the standards that they want to have in their life, that they can feel some ownership for. Absolutely. So it's an interesting thing, you know, we see people struggle, and it's not only people who are visibly poor or on a pension or have limited income. People struggle for a whole lot of reasons, but I think, Noel, you've got the right word. The most dignified way of assisting someone is to be available when they come knocking, and to help people know that supports are there when they need it, and to encourage people, and I encourage all of you, to step up to those that you know who might have a need and just quietly say, is there anything we can do? And put them in touch with one of the supports and services who can help them. And do it quietly, and do it privately, and don't tell everybody. Because that's the kind of support people who have most need really have a requirement for. Now we run a couple of teams for drought and bushfire recovery We have chaplains in the area. We're back to full-time chaplains in this area. They go into David and his wife have seen, I think, 400 or 500 families in the last 4 weeks here, between here and Tumut. So they go into houses and they knock on the door and they say, "Are you okay?" And then you can get, "Yeah, we're great, lovely to see you," or, "Look, actually, I'm about to fall apart, I can't cope," or anything between. But yeah, I think the best way to do it is that the best way to support people is by personal relationship. I think that, I hope that answers the question. but yes, and look, I see the work that this parish does and the other parishes in the region do, and they do that very well. So we would encourage you to continue. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.